From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, what does the entertainment industry need to learn from the arrest of Harvey Weinstein? Then actor Jussie Smollett traveled to Tennessee for the America Divided documentary series to seek out defenders of the state's Confederate statues.
They genuinely believe the nonsense that's coming out of their mouth. And the second that you start to question it with poise, with fact, with truth, suddenly they don't know what to say.
And singer-songwriter Mary Gaucher worked alongside military veterans for her latest album. All that coming right up.
KPCC supporters include Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
Harvey Weinstein walked into a New York courthouse this morning with a couple of show business history books tucked under his arm. A few minutes later, he left in handcuffs, changing Hollywood history in the process. The producer and studio executive was charged in two sexual assaults, one from 2004 and another from 2013. He posted a $1 million bond and was released pending trial. If convicted, Weinstein could serve as many as 25 years behind bars. To discuss the implications of his arrest for the industry and the Me Too movement going forward, I called up Deborah Katz. She's a lawyer in Washington, D.C., and she represents victims of workplace misconduct.
This is enormously important today. It is a clear indication that, number one, the New York DA is intent on holding him accountable for his crimes, and it sends a strong message to victims that we now have a cultural sea change where victims of violence are believed, and seeing Harvey Weinstein go on a perp walk and walk out with handcuffs will encourage other victims, whether they be to Harvey Weinstein and the Weinstein Company or in other arenas, to feel that people will listen to them and they can come forward.
A number of Weinstein Company employees have been implicated in news stories for having aided and abetted his behavior, looking the other way, or as often happened, helping craft non-disclosure agreements to buy his victims' silence. You have a client, Erwin Ryder, who is an executive at the Weinstein Company. What did he do when he heard about this kind of behavior, and is he accused of looking the other way?
No, he isn't. And in fact, the Attorney General made a statement thanking Mr. Ryder for coming forward. I went to the AG's office with Mr. Ryder, and Mr. Ryder was an important witness in jumpstarting the civil rights investigation. Not everybody at the Weinstein Company are bad people. My client is actually wearing a white hat in this situation. He's a good guy, and he did what he could to raise the issues as he became aware of them. But I can say that Mr. Ryder never knew how serious the rape allegations were. People knew that Harvey generally was a womanizer and had mistreated women, but never to this level. And that's the power of this moment, and the reporting by the New York Times and Ronan Farrow and the New Yorker is they interviewed so many dozens and dozens of women who came forward and spoke the truth. And this Me Too moment has encouraged other people to come forward. And without this moment, none of this would be happening. And we would still have a perpetrator on the loose. Today, we don't. Today, he's wearing an electronic monitoring device.
One of the things that I think comes up is the whole definition of what is and is not workplace harassment. Does there need to be a rethinking about how we define a workplace? And is that something that people should be talking about going forward?
It should. And listening to his lawyer's comments after the arraignment today were really disheartening. I mean, essentially, he said Harvey Weinstein did not invent the casting couch, as if forcing someone to have sex with you as a condition of getting a part in a play is somehow permissible. It is not. It's rape. It's coerced sex. And when you look at the workplace, when you have someone who's conducting business and reading scripts and casting people for roles outside of the workplace, the responsibility of the employer extends way outside of the workplace.
Well, let's talk about that, because Harvey Weinstein personally has been charged criminally, but there are companies that he worked for that have yet to be held accountable or even prosecuted. So what is the next step in that? And could that send a message as well that even if you look the other way, you might have some liability?
Well, the law has not kept pace in the way that advocates and civil rights lawyers such as myself believe it should. The statutes of limitations on sexual harassment claims are really short. The harassment has to be severe or pervasive, meaning one-off incidents are typically not considered actionable sexual harassment, except when they're assaults, which have been alleged in this case. But clearly, these companies should have known, reasonably should have taken action to prevent this kind of egregious abuse. And to the extent that employees and their lawyers and their PR people were enabling this behavior, they all should have liability. If the law doesn't go that far, it needs to go that far. If we're serious about eradicating this kind of behavior.
I want to talk about the role of the Human Resources Department. Who are they supposed to be advocates for, and where do they come up short? Because the New York Attorney General, in an earlier lawsuit against the Weinstein Company, said that there was an assistant to Harvey Weinstein who complained about his behavior to HR, and a very short time later, she saw her private email to HR forwarded back to Harvey Weinstein himself. So how does HR step up going forward? What do they need to do differently?
HR is a significant problem. HR officials have their paychecks signed by the companies. Often, HR officials do not have enough power to take on certainly owners and powerful executives, and they themselves are often vulnerable to retaliation when they themselves advocate on behalf of other victims. In the Weinstein Company, this HR role was a complete sham. The company did whatever it needed to do to protect their star harasser, and that is often the case. But HR can play a useful role, but only if there is autonomy and power. Unfortunately, that is often not the case, and HR is, in many, many cases that we are involved in, perceived to be an instrument of control and harassment by the employers.
Let me ask you this last question, and it's about three words, and those three words are, "We believe you." How important is it that now, maybe more so than even 6 months ago, people, when they hear these stories, believe them?
"We believe you" are probably three of the most important words that can be said. When people feel believed, they come forward. When people know that they do so and they risk having their reputation smeared and having campaigns to silence them, of the type that Harvey did, you're going to just reinforce this culture of silence and abuse. So "We believe you" are the first three most important words.
Deborah Katz is a partner at Katz, Marshall & Banks. It's a Washington, D.C. law firm that represents plaintiffs in sexual harassment cases. Deborah, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
KBCC podcasts are supported by Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series, and Freeform's Grown-ish, produced by ABC Signature Studios. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Comedy Series, Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for Yara Shahidi, and Outstanding Contemporary Costumes. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
Actor and singer Jussie Smollett is perhaps best known for his role as one of Terrence Howard's sons on the Fox TV series Empire, but this year he's also been an executive producer, along with TV legend Norman Lear and former Fox News anchor Gretchen Carlson, for a documentary series called America Divided on the Epix cable channel. The series examines issues of injustice and inequality in our society, including sanctuary cities, sexual harassment, Native American rights, and more. Smollett also hosted tonight's final episode. In it, he traveled to Tennessee to witness the growing movement to bring down Confederate monuments on the one hand and commemorate the deaths of African-American lynching victims on the other. When I spoke with Smollett, I asked about his connection to Confederate monuments.
It kind of goes without saying, it's something that I obviously care about, you know, the monuments. My mother comes from New Orleans, was born in Galveston, Texas, and, you know, my entire family from her side is from New Orleans and Galveston. It was something that we've always heard about before it became the popular discussion over, the truly popular discussion that was pretty vocal in the media as well. We've always known about that. So to me, it was always a personal issue that we take, you know, with the Confederate flag in itself, let alone the monuments.
When you started to look in the history of these monuments in the United States and learning more about them, was there anything that surprised you about their history that you maybe hadn't contemplated or thought about?
Honestly, what surprised me is actually the time in which they were erected. Some were erected during Jim Crow. Some were erected right after slavery. If you think about it, it really was kind of a slap in the face to progress, if you will. But also the fact of how we, as a nation, are okay with erasing the truth of history. For someone like Nathan Bedford Forrest, it's okay to say that he was a great soldier, a great warrior, a great leader, but then leave out things like he was a slave trader, leave out facts that he was, by many, many accounts, one of the first grand wizards of the KKK. We want to celebrate history, but whose history? Whose agenda? That's what really, really was interesting, is just the humanity of it all, or the lack of humanity.
You talk to people on both sides of the debate, and I want to ask you about a conversation that's obviously very difficult for you to be in, and I think for us to watch, yeah, with Lee Miller. He's the local spokesperson for the Sons of the Confederate Veterans, and he's also the spokesperson for the Nathan Bedford Forrest family. And he and other supporters of keeping the statue up say that Forrest had a change of heart later in his life and actually championed the rights of Black people. He also says, even though the historical record, because I looked at it, is pretty much unequivocal, denies that Forrest was a prominent and early leader in the Ku Klux Klan. So let's listen to part of your conversation with Lee Miller.
Why not say that here stands a man that was a slave trader, that was a slave owner?
Yes.
Had this come to Jesus moment?
Yes.
And realized that his ways were wrong?
Because people will not say that, what you just said. He did change from feeling that slaves were just slaves, they were just property. He recognized that they were men, that the Black men were men. They could fight like the white guys. They could run businesses like the white men.
But do you see the way that the Confederacy attempts to extract the history and the legacy of slavery, of racism, of violence from the narrative?
No, I don't think that's trying to extract that or cover that up. I think the emphasis is on promoting the good side, the bravery of the soldiers.
Because that's the story that affects you. That's the story that affects your people.
Yes.
And then our history is in fact extracted. Our history is in fact ignored.
So let's just add one little thing too. In one of the signs commemorating his life, his slave trading is called what? His business enterprises?
Right.
It's a remarkable conversation. What was your takeaway from that? And what were you feeling in the middle of it?
They caught the most, the most professional moments. For sure. You know, because there were moments where I had to stop and say, let's be clear, I'm an artist, I'm not a journalist. And it's taking every fiber in my being not to run over and pounce the out of him. I kept thinking to myself, what would Oprah do? And really had to calm myself and center myself. I think that there's a moment in there, it's a wide shot, and if you really look, both Lee Miller's and myself, our legs are just shaking, like this nervous shaking of just this agitated, frustrated moment between the both of us. To sit across from somebody and look them in the eyes and see that this is not a script, this is not a role that they're playing believably. They genuinely believe the nonsense that's coming out of their mouth. They truly, truly believe it. And the second that you start to question it with poise, with fact, with truth, suddenly they don't know what to say. And it was a very interesting moment for me, something that I'll remember forever.
We're talking with Jussie Smollett about his episode of America Divided. You mentioned how the idea of truth and reconciliation is kind of a thematic element in the series, and South Africa dealt very publicly with its history,
especially
through its Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And you mentioned in the show, if you visit Germany, which I have done, there is no effort to mask that country's history. In Berlin, there's the Jewish Museum, the Holocaust Memorial, the Topography of Terror, just to name a few. Our nation and the South in particular have a slightly different approach, it seems, to what we're going to say about our own history. Why do you think we are in that place where we don't want to talk about it and pretend it never happened?
You know, I think one of the most poignant interviews in America Divided is I'm speaking to this older white woman. I ask her a question very similar to what you just asked me, and she said, I think that we white people are afraid of what we will lose, of what the truth actually is. We don't want to deal with that. It's a painful thing to deal with the past. But if none of us are actually, in fact, still doing that, then we can actually acknowledge that maybe our family members did. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Exactly.
There's no reason. Nathan Bedford Forrest is dead. There's no reason why the family of Nathan Bedford Forrest should not be able to say, listen, he was wrong. He was foul. We should not be celebrating him in this way. Why is that so difficult to do that?
And there's another part of that equation, and that is to recognize the people who were lynched, the people
absolutely
who were murdered because of the color of their skin and nothing else. In fact, you talk about somebody who was lynched because he asked for a receipt from a store where he had a charge account. And there is now a monument to the victims of lynching in the United States. And you talk with Brian Stevens, he's from the Equal Justice Project, about the site of the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, which just opened in Montgomery, Alabama. For those who don't know about this museum, why is it important? What does it represent in terms of a small change in the conversation that we're having about our nation's history?
Jesse Lee, he was lynched in the 30s. The body was stuck down at the bottom of the river. He was castrated and lynched, and no one ever has acknowledged it. And his brother is still alive, and he's 97 years old. What crushes me, what breaks my heart, is the fact that this is a 97-year-old man and he has so much love in his heart. But he was aware, he was old enough to know what was happening, what happened to his brother. And he's lived his entire life just wanting someone to acknowledge it. It's important. And that's what the museum represents. And it also is a way, to be honest, it's to shame certain cities into acknowledging and recognizing what happened actually in their towns, in their cities, in their states. Every single marker, you will be able to come and collect your marker. Every city will be able to come and collect their marker. And if you haven't, you'll also be able to see what city did not collect their marker. You know, sometimes you got to shame people into doing the right thing.
If audiences watch this episode and understand a little bit of that, about how to be strong and forgiving and to make sure that we remember what we've done in many of our own lifetimes, how does it change you as an artist?
For me, that's all I've ever done is try to... Here's the thing. We have a platform where a lot of people are listening to us as artists. And I mean any type of artist. If we're good people, we could lead a lot of people to be understanding, to be loving, to be caring, to be forthright and honest and loyal. But we could also help steer them into a completely opposite direction. It really makes you understand the responsibility to tell the truth.
Jussie Smollett is an actor, producer, and musician. Jussie, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
America Divided, Whose History, airs tonight at 9 on the EPIX Premium Cable Channel. Coming up on The Frame, songwriter Mary Gaucher says the key to working with military veterans on her latest album was finding their vulnerability. Award-winning singer and songwriter Mary Gaucher brought military veterans and their families into the writing process for her latest album. It's called Rifles and Rosary Beads. KPCC Veteran Affairs reporter Libby Dankman spoke with Gaucher and with a wounded service member who says their collaboration helped heal the invisible injuries of war.
Joshua Gertz joined the Army after high school. He had some uncles who served, and he thought college wasn't for him. That was 1999. Fast forward a few years to Gertz driving a truck on his last night of deployment in Iraq.
My vehicle was hit with a roadside bomb, which left me with brain injury and some spinal cord damage. I'm not wheelchair bound, but it makes things difficult.
It was the psychological wounds that nearly killed Gertz. At one point, after returning home to his wife, Lisa, and two sons in New York, he attempted suicide.
I felt like I was a burden, and it was almost like I wanted my family to be able to laugh again.
Lisa was looking for help when she came across a news article about a nonprofit that pairs veterans with professional songwriters.
Knowing my love for music, she thought it would be something that I would maybe go to.
Rifles and rosary beads, you hold on.
Gertz grew up near Buffalo in a musical family, but he'd never written a song before. And that's common, says Nashville singer-songwriter Mary Gaucher. She's been volunteering as a mentor with Songwriting with Soldiers for about 5 years. The organization holds several retreats a year all over the country. Each veteran produces a song by the end of the weekend. It's free to service members and their partners. Here's Mary Gaucher.
Soldiers are trained not to be vulnerable, but when they come home, they've got to learn it. And part of telling the story is being uncomfortably vulnerable. But that's what songs do.
War of my baby from my breast, now my name in rank.
This year, Gaucher released an entire album co-written with military veterans from the program. The 11 tracks on Rifles and Rosary Beads dig deep into the veteran experience, including stories you may not typically associate with military service. The song Brothers takes listeners to the emotional deployment of a new mom.
Why my face changed my soaking bra, told my body not to feel at all, tried to be like you, what must I do to prove that I'm a brother too?
I learned a lot writing with Megan Cunahan and Brittany Fadd, being the first generation of females in combat. And the mantra that they had to deal with is no special treatment.
Another track was co-written with half a dozen military wives and songwriter Beth Nielsen Chapman, who wrote the monster hit This Kiss for Faith Hill.
Beth and I sat with the wives, and they started to talk about what they called the war after the war.
There's landmines in the living room, and eggshells on the floor. Lost myself in the shadow of your honor and your pain.
They have to serve in silence a lot of the time. And our veterans have told me over and over again, look, the hero here is my wife.
Invisible. The war after the war.
You know, Leonard Cohen said it best, the crack is how the light gets in. We don't connect at our strengths. We connect at our vulnerabilities.
On the first night of the retreat, Josh Gertz came in skeptical. But Gaucher's vulnerable performance convinced him she would be a reliable songwriting partner.
It was just something about her words, being able to express so many complex feelings with such a simple way of saying it.
So they started talking, Gaucher looking for a way to uncover his song.
She said, so, you know, looking back on it, What do you think that one thing that's kind of weighing you down is? And so, I don't know, who the hell knows?
Looking back now, who the hell knows where the soul of a dead soldier goes?
I was just blown away that it could be that simple. And then once I started opening up and being truly honest with her, I think Mary saw where the true hurt, my true pain was coming from.
That song became Still on the Ride. Instead of dwelling on his own life-changing injuries, Gertz chose to memorialize a fallen friend. Thomas Falk died November 7th, 2000, just before their one-year anniversary in the Army.
I shouldn't be here. You shouldn't be gone. But it's not up to me who dies and who carries on.
I mean, we spent pretty much every second of every day together since the day we joined the Army, and he was family.
My eyes. Me and my guardian angel were still on the ride.
I shouldn't be here. Why him and not me? With all that, I should be the one. And I think from that kind of stemmed the idea that maybe he went first to be my guardian angel and make sure I made it through those things. Double vision, and my
stomach's in my... Gertz says he works every day to maintain his mental health. He's played harmonica on stage with Mary Gaucher on her Rifles and Rosary Beads tour, and he credits songwriting with soldiers with helping him open up and trust someone else with his story.
It's always going to be there. You just have better training, better tools to deal with it, and more support to deal with it. I shouldn't be
here. You shouldn't be gone. For The Frame, I'm Libby Denkman. But it's not up to me.
That's our show for this week. There's breaking news from the art world today. The Museum of Contemporary Art has announced today that its director, Philippe Verne, will leave when his contract expires next March. And today we say farewell to producer Michelle Lanz, who has been with The Frame since we launched. She's head of her podcast adventures in New York. Bye, Michelle. I'm John Horn. Listen for The Frame summer movie special throughout the weekend. We'll see you back here next Tuesday.